right. So for the first of our Development West Coast Forever a Coaster series, I'd like to welcome Jake Miller all the way from Sun Valley, Idaho. What's a West Coast boy doing in Sun Valley, Idaho?
Well, firstly, Julie, it's a huge honor to be doing this with you. I think I've interviewed you now about five times. This is the first time we've flipped the camera. So it's an honor to be here. I just got in from LA this morning, here to film an unfiltered interview on Tuesday with a gentleman by the name of Julian Robinson, who founded Tiger Management. Julian's based in New York, but he actually has an interesting tie to New Zealand because he owns Kauri Cliffs and Cape Kidnappers. And he's out here on vacation. So rather than go over to New York, I said, well, I'll come and meet you in Sun Valley. So that's why I'm here.
Oh, that's fantastic. Jacob's, of course, the founder of Unfiltered TV. That was your second startup, which is about business size, insights, inspiration, and a coaching platform. Why did you decide to go into education?
Oh man, I ask myself that some days, but I guess it's all I've ever been doing since I left school, because my first business was also kind of in the online inspiration learning, you know, education kind of industry. And although the content we were creating at the time was much more targeted towards school leavers, when I sold that business in 2015, I guess it was all I really knew how to do at that point was interviewing people. So I was trying to think about what to do next. And at the time I had a bunch of ideas in food tech and a whole range of industries, task management software and so on. And I talked to a lot of different businesses and door knocked a lot of restaurants in New York about maybe starting this food tech platform. But in the end, I kind of came back to what I knew, I guess. And what I knew was interviewing people. And I thought I knew business, and I certainly wanted to learn more about business. So in some ways, I was creating a product that I myself wanted. And that was almost 5 years ago this November. And ever since then, we've been filming ever since. So plenty of ups and downs like any business, but it's good fun as well.
We're going to talk about some of those ups and downs soon. So from Greymouth High School to Forbes magazine 30 Under 30, North America and Canada, what connection do you have to the West Coast these days?
Yeah, I mean, I love the coast, and this has actually been the longest period of time I've ever spent out of New Zealand. The last time I was back was in, I think, September, late August, early September. And now we're sitting here, what's today, 5th of July here in the US. And that's the longest time ever I've been out of the country. So in terms of New Zealand, I have a great connection to the country, but in terms of the coast, even more so than New Zealand as a whole. I mean, when I think of New Zealand, for me, I think of, frankly, two parts of the country. It's either Queenstown or the coast. That's what is New Zealand for me. And when I come back, I pretty quickly get on a domestic flight and go to one of those two places. So whenever I come to the coast, it's typically at Christmas time where we go camping at Lake Canary with your good self, and absolutely love it there. I mean, to me, it means family. It's, you know, tranquil, it's beautiful, it's pure. And I know New Zealand has been known for all of these things over the years, and you know, the country has been trying to differentiate itself outside of purely this clean green image. But I have to say, when I think of New Zealand, there's nowhere purer in the world than the West Coast. And I know for me, as a kid growing up there, I had so much fun there, you know, motorbike riding and jet skiing on Lake Canary and Lake Brunner, and swimming in the ocean and hiking and so on. So whenever I go back there now, for me, what it's about is really just doing those things and just reconnecting with what's most important in the world, getting outdoors, and yeah, just trying to disconnect, really, because it's probably the best place in the world to disconnect. Whenever there's nowhere else in the world I can go and actually really turn off, whereas at Canary, for example, I can really go there, not take my phone and just enjoy it, which is a beautiful thing.
It's not much use of phone at Lake Canary generally.
That's true. Although there's the Boniface's house, I'm sure you know them, just down the road, they have a Wi-Fi extender now. So if you go and stand on their lawn, you can actually hook into their Wi-Fi.
Yeah, people sit on our front steps looking for the Wi-Fi as well. Yeah.
Unfortunately, they haven't got it at the campground yet.
But it's a lovely little dot campground, isn't it? It's a great one. Do you look at any of your personal attributes and say, that's so West Coast?
Yeah, I think so. I think my hunger for isolation, actually, because even when I'm over here in the US or anywhere in the world, I'm quite often running away by myself to somewhere quite remote, vacationing myself, getting off the grid and going somewhere really remote. And I think back now and I'm like, I don't think I would have that. If I'd grown up in Manhattan or whatever, and I'd always been around people as a kid, I don't think I would want to be by myself in the bush. Whereas just now I came down from a hike up in the wilderness up here and I was by my, like completely by myself. Even when I go skiing, I'm always trying to go off the track to lose myself in the mountains so that I can't see anyone else. So I think certainly independence, I would say, and just not being afraid to be alone in places and go to new places, and just the independence that comes with that, I think, is definitely something that came from the coast.
And from what I know about you, a fair dose of tenacity as well, which I think is a very West Coast thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
no for an answer, you just find another way.
Exactly. And definitely pushing, you know, knocking down doors and continuing to push forward because, you know, and I think back now, I mean, there's probably a lot of hunger that came from the West Coast as well, because there's so much beauty, and not just beauty in terms of the natural landscape, but beauty in terms of the way the coast is, in terms of, you know, people values and family values and all of those things that are so important. And I think for me, what I've tried to do is keep that stuff at the forefront while not letting that define me. Like, I always wanted more, and I'm the first to admit I wanted to get out of Greymouth and create some wealth for myself. And I still am driven by that. But at the same time, I'm also driven by those values that I think I grew up with as a kid that I probably wouldn't have if I grew up in a place like New York, for example.
Speaking of being a kid, your father Rod died in the Fox Glacier skydiving plane crash in 2010. Along with 8 others. You were maybe, were you 13 or 14 years old?
I was 15, so it's 10 years this September.
Yeah, how did that change the way you, I guess a lot of people on the coast probably knew your dad. How did that change your future?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been at boarding school for about a year, not a year, maybe six to seven months at that point in Christchurch. And it definitely changed. I mean, it changed a heap of things, right? Because my dad had a great business. And I was actually thinking about it this morning because, you know, when we talk about business today and creating successful businesses, there's almost this like unspoken expectation that everybody has to be trying to scale something massive and build this global company that, you know, makes billions of dollars. Whereas that's bullcrap if you don't want to do that, you know. Like, he had a great business and it was limited in terms of its scale, but who cares, you know. We had a great childhood and we had a lot of fun. So what is a successful business? I mean, that's what I was thinking about this morning, because by all means he had a very successful business. So as kids we had the best childhood I could possibly ever want to this day, even having, you know, grown up in my early 20s around a lot of kids that have come from immense privilege. Like, I think back to when we were living on the coast, and as I say, we were motorbike riding and hiking and jet skiing and skiing and skydiving and just having so much fun outdoors all of the time. And the old thing,
your first parachute jump, were you like 5 or?
Yeah, I was 5, and my dad always used to say boys and their toys, and that was sort of our childhood to the extreme, to the extent that I was learning to fly age 13. So it was very privileged, and I don't, you know, a lot of people aren't blessed to have that, but my dad worked really hard. So when he died in 2010, I guess a few things changed. Firstly, a lot of that was taken away. So all of a sudden mum sold the motorbike, sold the jet ski, moved into a smaller house, stopped paying for flying lessons, sold the remote control planes, blah, 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 blah. And I get it, she needed the money and she wasn't making any money. But for us as kids, that sucked to have all of that taken away. So I think a lot of my drive probably came from that, because, you know, I wanted to get that back into my life and start creating some wealth to enjoy what I had as a kid. That was certainly one thing. And then probably as well, I mean, just, you know, I met John Key, the story's been told before, but I met John Key quite soon after my father died, because Pike River happened about a month after. And he had been coming to the coast as Prime Minister quite a lot at the time to speak to the victims of Pike River and so on. And I wrote him a letter because he visited the crash site. And I thought that was a really honorable thing for him to do, because he definitely didn't have to get in his Crown car and drive 2.5 hours down the coast to Fox Glacier. And I wrote him a letter and just thanked him. And he wrote back and said he wanted to have lunch. And he came to our lunch in Greymouth for whitebait sandwiches, very quintessentially West Coast, and just to chat about my future. And at the time I was 15, I was obsessed about politics, not anymore at all, but at the time I was. And he came and basically gave me some advice as to how I could, hopefully be successful at school and then maybe get into politics one day. And definitely he had a massive effect on my inspiration as a kid, because his father had died when he was 7. And I remember thinking, you know, he went on to achieve his dreams. If he could, why couldn't I? So that definitely was something that came from dad dying as well.
Mine died when I was 5. It's interesting, isn't it? It does change us all, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
It's just that bit more of tenacity, I guess.
Yeah.
Head boy at Christchurch Boys High when you won a university law scholarship, but turned it down, decided not to do tertiary education, but go straight into business. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah, I mean, looking back now, it should have been a hard decision, but it wasn't, frankly, because I was so determined to get out and create something. And by that point, I was a little bit fed up with the school system, to be honest. And I was just sick of working the system. And when I say working the system, I was head boy of my school. And in order to do that, it was relatively political at a big school like Christchurch Boys. And I got to a point where I was so sick of having to impress the right people, do the right things, and essentially pretend to like people and teachers and stuff who I didn't really have much time for, frankly. Some of them, not all of them, of course. And I got to a point where I was like, this is just what I'm going to end up doing in the corporate world. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to study law. And then I'm going to be working in a law firm as a junior. And I'm probably going to spend the next 15 years pissing in my boss's pocket, trying to become a partner. And then I'm going to get into politics and do the exact same thing. And I just thought, I can't imagine anything worse at this point. So I was sort of probably lost without knowing I was lost, if that makes sense. And then I picked up Sir Richard Branson's autobiography, Losing My Virginity. And I was just like, wow, this is it. And it was really as simple as that. And I think at that point, and that's why I'm so passionate about what we do at Unfiltered, because one of our beliefs as a company is that a spark of inspiration can change everything. And I'm a living example of that, because that was a spark. It was literally just a book. I bought the book at Paper Plus in Greymouth. I remember it as clear as day. I walked in, I bought it. I wasn't looking for it. I just saw it, picked it up, and everything changed. So that was a spark for me. And basically, once I read that, I don't know whether I was inspired by my dad running his business as a kid or when I was a kid or whatever it was, but I decided it was me. So turning down the scholarship became quite fun, actually, because I got to sort of like see everyone's reactions. And I felt maybe my ego had been satisfied by being offered it. So then it became, okay, I'm good enough to have it. So now it's my choice to turn it down. So I rang up the Dean of Law at the University of Otago and explained the dilemma to him. And he, to his credit, just said, look, if you want to go and start a business, you should go and start a business. He said, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen? You're going to fail. And in 4 or 5 years, if you do, you can ring me up. The door will still be open. We'll work it out at that point. So I think when you're young, you have so much opportunity to take those risks and make those comparatively sort of big, bold decisions as such. And that's the time to do it. And it's not just to say it's only when you're young, but you really do have the freedom at that point. So and Mark Hennigan, the Dean of Law, I mean, I just rate that guy so much. We keep in touch to this day. We exchange emails all the time. And he was a big sort of influence in me turning the scholarship down.
Do you think we put too much emphasis on having to have a formal tertiary education?
You know, I used to be more closed-minded to it than I am now. I've actually humbled a little bit on it, because when I was 18 or 19, you know, things had only gone pretty well, to be fair. Like, but by the time I was 20, I'd started my first business. I'd sold it. I'd pocketed $250,000, moved to New York, you know, and I didn't have anything to start with. I had no startup capital or anything. So I kind of went from having nothing to being a 20-year-old with a pretty good lifestyle pretty quick. So I would say if you asked me that when I was 20, I would have been, you know, screw university, just go out and do whatever you want. Whereas the school of hard knocks, as we often talk about, Julie, you start to learn that that life is not always easy. And I look back now and I'm like, I certainly don't regret what I did, but I wouldn't change anything, but I'm softer on the idea of if I'd spent, say, 4 or 5 years going through college, growing up a little bit, learning about the world, learning about myself, and maybe starting something at university or starting something afterwards. I still wouldn't do it, but I'm certainly not anti-university. I think if you don't know what you want to do, it's a good place to go. As long as you're studying something useful that you're passionate about, it's probably a good place to go and learn about the world, because as a young person, you have so much, you know, that is really going to influence your views on everything for the rest of your life. And having that almost clear horizon of 4 years to read books and watch documentaries and develop your opinions and perspectives and hopefully travel a lot, do some semesters overseas. You're going to come out a very well-rounded person if you use that time smartly, I think.
That's right. Yeah. So now you've interviewed more than 350 business leaders all over the world. Who has inspired you the most? Other than Richard Branson, because we know that you have a boy crush on Richard Branson, but you know.
Other than yourself, Julie, I mean, your story is phenomenal. I mean, you're one of the first people I ever interviewed for Oomph, and then again for Unfiltered twice. And you've obviously hosted some sessions at Unfiltered Live and everything. So, I mean, huge respect for your story. And it's so nice to be able to have those stories that you can really relate to, you know, because like obviously having come from the coast as well and being able to see that. I remember as a kid really looking up to you long before I knew you, because I remembered your story from Dragon's Den. So I don't think we should underestimate the importance of sort of peer stories. But yeah, I mean, I having been in the US now filming for 4 or so years, we've filmed hundreds of episodes, but a couple that come to mind, I mean, there was a guy called, a guy is called Keith Kruk, and he founded a company called Ariba, which he built into a, I believe in the dot-com bubble, their market capitalization, their value was worth something like $40 or $50 billion. A massive, massive technology company. And then he ended up selling that to SAP, one of the biggest software companies in the world. And then he became chairman and CEO of DocuSign, which when he joined was a relatively small business. And he grew that by about 120 times growth during his time as CEO. We interviewed him right at the time he was chairman of DocuSign, stepping down as CEO. And now he got appointed as Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy and the Environment. So he reports directly to Pompeo. And you know, he wanted to give back to the US. He's one of the nicest guys in the world. I would say that he would be doing the same thing if Trump wasn't president. I don't think it's a Trump thing. It's more of a service thing. He was the youngest ever president at General Motors at 26, I believe. Vice president, sorry. Just a phenomenal guy. And we learned a lot from him around service and significance and also just believing in people. Like he cultivated this incredible network around him, and he called it the DocuSign advisory board, and he appointed me to it, which blew my mind, because I was about 21 at the time and I was at this guy's house in San Francisco, and he invited me to join this advisory board. And literally alongside, I'm sitting there with General Stanley McChrystal, four-star general, former commander US forces Afghanistan under Obama, Dan Golden, former administrator of NASA, the former CEO of McDonald's, you know, the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Business Review, all of these people have now met. And Stanley McChrystal, Dan Golden from NASA, Adi Ignatius from HBR, they've all become friends. So it really was this like incredible group of people. And what I admired so much about what Keith did is he just had hundreds of people around him, and he did such a good job of really authentically maintaining those relationships, connecting people. And it wasn't superficial. It wasn't tacky. They weren't there for the wrong reasons, but everybody loved being a part. Everyone loves being Keith's friend, because he's just the nicest guy in the world. And he's always making an effort to facilitate interesting connections. So he's been a truly phenomenal person to interview. I also think about Rick Caruso, who built The Grove in LA, and he's a top sort of hotel property entrepreneur, and just the class and style. And again, the sort of civic leadership as well, because he was, I believe, president of the Los Angeles Police Commission.
Is this something they all have in common? Is this something you see in the successful people that you interview? Is there something they have in common?
I mean, I think service and significance is a big thing. And I know I just said that, but I really think that the people who are most successful, because what is success? Again, I come back to this example. It's not necessarily about scale. It's about satisfaction, and it's about someone being comfortable with themselves. I think about my best friend's dad, and he was a big time money manager at Fidelity, one of the world's great finance companies. And he stood down, I believe, in his mid-40s. And now he basically travels around the world, you know, seeing his kids and going to their graduations. friends and, you know, going on holiday with them. And, you know, he's been doing that for 10 years and playing golf and spending time with his wife. And he's probably the most successful guy I know. So yeah. I think about success and I'm like, look, it's not necessarily about the person that's built the biggest company. It's about who's the happiest and who's the most satisfied in their own skin. Of course, you always want to be striving for more. You want to have those goals in front of you. But I think we can get into this trap of just perpetually striving and striving, and the finish line always moves, and that's fine, but you have to be able to find some form of happiness and satisfaction on that journey. So when I think about these guys, Caruso, Keith Krack, you know, I think they're definitely striving for more, but there's definitely something there where they're serving, it's about more than themselves, that they're serving industries and people and causes that they deeply believe in. They have a purpose that's really strong. Like I think about Rick Caruso and the spaces he's created at the Grove and the Rosewood and Montecito and these beautiful properties. And what really drives him is bringing people joy. He wants to make people happy. So he creates these spaces and, you know, literally down to what is the smell that's coming out in the shopping mall and how am I going to change the where the trees go to make people happier and make them feel like it reminds them of their childhood or whatever it is. And every little decision comes down to how can I make people happy? It's almost like Walt Disney-like. So, and he's been called the Walt Disney of retail by Forbes. So I think about that and service and significance. I mean, you have to be serving a cause, but you also have to feel significant. And you have to have a purpose, I think.
So just for the people out there, they can see these interviews on unfiltered.tv.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the reason I love talking about the Rick Caruso one is I think it's probably the finest example ever of our work. In terms of the production value, you know, Rick just being a phenomenal interviewee. I think I was on form that day. Everything was just great. It's a really phenomenal piece. It's his name is Rick Caruso, C-A-R-U-S-O, and it's online now.
Right, cool. On the coast and New Zealand in general, we're pretty bad at celebrating success. What do you think we can do to overcome that tall poppy syndrome?
I think, you know, I think firstly, you know, I think it will get, you know, this is a very optimistic response because I've been quite vocal on what I think about it, but I think it will slowly get better in time because of the younger generations coming through who are achieving success and starting to build businesses. And I think younger generations inherently have grown up in this world of social media and sort of more of a online kind of global world as such. So I think, you know, I think it will naturally, hopefully, this is an optimistic opinion, but hopefully flush itself out a little bit as time goes on. I don't think that's the only answer though. I certainly think, I think it requires people to just stand up for themselves and for their friends and for what they believe in. And I know now whenever I have anybody sort of, you know, giving me negative energy because of anything I've done, whether that be my success or otherwise, I just have no tolerance. And I'm pretty black and white about it. Like I'll cut people out of my life pretty fast if I get those vibes coming through. And I think we actually need more people to stand up for, not just for myself, but also for my friends as well. If I'm getting an energy of people, you know, essentially people being around you who aren't filling your glass and they're not happy for your success. And we all have those energy stealers in our lives. And you know that they're not happy for you or they don't want you to be successful. They, you know, they're sort of happy, but you can tell they're not. I mean, I've just got no tolerance for that. And I think the more people can have no tolerance for that, the faster it will hopefully go away as well. It's not, you know, I don't want to sound cutthroat, like I just cut people out. I mean, I'd like to try and help people, bring people on a journey. But you know, it's not just about me as well, because we've been interviewing successful people as such ever since I was 18 years old. So, you know, our companies have literally been built around the idea of building up successful people and celebrating their success. So I guess we're particularly exposed to it in a sense, because we've had people criticize us, sure, but we also hear people criticize the people we're celebrating all of the time. And whenever that happens, we try and just have no tolerance for that either. The final thing I'd say is I think as well, just being a more global country is helpful. Like I don't support locking down, you know, not allowing people to come in and buy homes from around the world and all of this nonsense, because you're just shutting the borders down and making New Zealand more secluded and isolated. And we live in a global world with no borders, essentially. contrary to what Donald Trump would have us all believe, but we should be opening the country up, bringing in the best and brightest from around the world, integrating them into the community, and becoming a more global international country. It's not going to happen if we just shut the borders down. Of course, normalizing COVID, I understand that there's a need.
These are challenging times. But what sort of businesses do you see as being the stars of the future? And what you're coming across in the States and in your interviews, do you see any trends in the sort of businesses you think will do well?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely businesses that really bring something I'm really obsessed about right now is personalization, like really advanced personalization based off technology and the data that we can capture. Like I really believe that the future of everything is highly personalized. I think about my healthcare in New Zealand. There's a great company in Auckland called Edison that I'm a member of. And you know, they did all this blood testing and DNA testing, and then told me what time I should be getting up in the morning and sleeping and what I should be eating and shouldn't be eating. Not in general, but based off my own genetic makeup, I know that I'm, you know, more likely to get type 2 diabetes because of this, and I can minimize that by not doing this because this gene comes from my granddad, you know, et cetera. So the point I'm trying to make is that's a highly personalized approach to healthcare. They call it preventative healthcare because you're essentially hopefully preventing the illnesses by knowing the things you can do in advance. Health's just one example. I mean, I think about food and this is another health example, but my vitamins these days have my name on the front. My hair conditioner and shampoo is tailored to my genetic hair makeup. So it says my name on the front, and it's a specific type of shampoo, and it's not expensive. It may be slightly more expensive than what you're going to get at the supermarket, but everything is becoming more personalized. Unfiltered as a business, we're trying to make our platform highly personalized so each individual learner can come on and have different goals and aspirations. So I think that's a really big thing. And then I think in general, just this is nothing new, but just customer, obsessing about customer success and, you know, keeping the customer at the forefront of a business, because people are learning so much around customer making customers happy. And I think if you're not doing that, you know, in really unique ways today, it's easy to get left behind. So I think that's really important. And then I think it was Bill Gates who said that we often overestimate the change certain technologies will bring in a year, but we underestimate them in 10 years. And that is just so true. Like, I think things like autonomous driving and so on, like in the next year, we're not going to probably see a big change. But in the next 10 years, I really think, like, you know, people won't be driving their own cars. And I think that's really scary if you're in any industry like trucking or anything. You know, we've interviewed some of the top founders of autonomous driving companies in the US. I went in one recently in Pittsburgh because one of them's our client, Argo AI. They just raised $2.6 billion from VW and $1 billion from Ford. So they're a $7.5 billion startup that is literally making autonomous driving technology. I went in their car in Pittsburgh. It was seamless. It was very, very good. We drove around for half an hour. I don't think the guy touched the steering wheel once. And this was
if there was no driver, it surely would have been a little bit scary.
It was, yeah. So they're at a stage at the moment where the driver still sits there, but they hover over the wheel. But it was things like someone opened a car door and our car swerved, and the amount of data points coming into the car is just insane. And it's going to get to a point where it's way more effective than us as humans, because we can only take so much in.
You're obviously very in tune with, you know, advances in technology, but I'm quite fascinated now with the revival of old jobs. Like, who would have thought being a barber would be so cool like it is now? Barbering, particularly brewing, it's like every boy's dream now is to have their own, you know, their own craft beer brewery. You know, there's also a big revival in classic, in baristering, what it became, you know. There's a revival in classic jobs too, isn't there?
I agree. And it comes back to what I said right at the start around people, the single biggest advice to anyone starting a business, the first thing you should do is work out what you want, because you don't have to want to start something that's going to take over the world. Like, the happiest times of my life, and of course they were because I was a kid, but at the same time, like, I think back to my parents and how happy they were, I believe. And my dad's business was very successful and it was never going to globally scale, but who cares? Like, he made plenty of money and had a great time and jumped out of planes every day for a living. So if you love what you're doing, like, it doesn't, you might be doing a hiking or a touring business on the West Coast, or, you know, a skiing company or whatever. It's like, don't feel inferior because of the limitations of scale. I mean, that's just conventional wisdom, and a lot of that's just BS.
Isn't it wonderful if your passion can become your job? And that's what happened to me, you know, as my passion became my job. That is the ideal, I think, really, isn't it? You know?
I agree. Yeah. And I think often what happens, though, with when people do try and scale too fast, and I'm sure you found this, Julie, is like, it starts off that way, but then as it becomes a business, you more move into managerial. So then you're hiring and firing and managing people. Whereas really all you probably wanted to be doing was writing the next documentary, you know?
That's absolutely right. And it's the people who are always the challenge, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So you raised $3 million in investment for Unfiltered. What did you learn through that process? I mean, just kind of go back to, like, if I was starting up and I was even trying to raise, you know, 100K without borrowing from my auntie, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
What did you learn about how to convince people to invest in you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, yeah, we've now raised about $3 million US, and that's over three rounds. So we didn't raise any money immediately. We bootstrapped or self-funded the business for the first year. And that was the best thing we ever did. And then we probably raised money too early or before we had sort of a proper commercial scalable product market fit. So my bit of advice on raising money is firstly work out what you want, like what I just said, because if you want to create a great life for yourself and an amazing job that just happens to be your business, don't raise money. Because when you raise money, there's instantly an expectation that you're going to scale something big and, you know, you're going to return a heap of money to these investors. So that puts pressure on you. So raising money is definitely not for every business. That's the first thing I'd say. Secondly, I'd say, unless you're raising money from very, very high risk, high reward investors, and they are out there, then you should find a product market fit that works first before raising money. The money should then be essentially fuel for the fire. You want to raise money once the fire is there, because in America, it's very common for people to go out and raise $10 million off an idea before it's even started. But that can happen here because that's how the venture capital funds work. And they're looking for these big ideas that may just change the world. And they operate off a model where out of every 10, only one's going to work, but that one's going to hopefully become Uber. So who cares about the other nine? But that just doesn't exist in New Zealand. So when we raised money, we probably weren't really ready. Like, we were still working out what we were doing. You know, we were still working out our product market fit. We had too many people probably for the size we were. Our burn rate was too high. So we raised money, and then it pretty quickly became the money was extending that runway while we worked out the future iterations of the business. And we've been through that a few times. You know, we still haven't got it perfect. We believe where we are now is really exciting, but we still haven't fully cracked it yet. And that's hard because investors start to, you know, want to see more progress. And, you know, some investors, we've got something like 35 shareholders. That's my next bit of advice. Probably don't do that. The less the better.
35
opinions. And I'm incredibly grateful for every single one of them, of course, but you've got to remember that everyone has different expectations of A, how big it's going to be, B, how fast it's going to be until they get their money back, and different amounts of financial wealth as well. I've got investors that are multi-billionaires. I've got others that are struggling to pay for their next house. So you've got certain investors wanting the money back to pay off their mortgage, other investors who you never hear from because it's just a drop in the bucket, and then others that get really, really, really involved. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's not. So what I would say is do your due diligence on your investors as well. Rather than just them doing their due diligence on you, like, definitely look at who they've invested in before, what's worked, what hasn't. Pick up the phone to an entrepreneur they've given money to before. Say, is person XYZ a great investor? What did you learn from them? Would you take their money again? That's the acid question.
It's very difficult to have silent investors. They always want to, buy into you usually because they believe in the person or the founder, and that can have its disadvantages. That can be quite draining for you as a person, can't it?
Exactly. I mean, there's two, in my opinion, there's two types of investors that are the best in the world. The first is the one that has a heap of money, gives it to you, and you never hear from them. And the second is the one that gets actively involved, but actually can add value. What you don't want is someone that's involved, but can't really add any value.
What you really want is the first one, though.
I mean, that's second best, actually. The best is active, but can facilitate connections, can help you grow the business, believes in you, is there for the long haul. They are hard to find and very specific to each individual business. So if I was doing it again, and I had, first of all, I've got to say, if I had the opportunity, because the reason I have 35 shareholders is not because I wanted 35 shareholders. It's because people, when they're writing $100,000 checks, then you have to have more than one or two. But if things were really good and I had someone offering $1 million check, for example, I would love to have one or two high impact investors, both sit on the board. You're friendly with them. You get on well, you align personality wise, you have similar motivations, values alignment, really important. And then just regular communication, because the other thing about having a lot of investors is the communication suffers. So I can't give every 35 of my shareholders the communication that they probably want, because I'll just be managing investors where I'm trying to grow the business. So, yeah. And some of them don't want it, some of them do. So everyone has different expectations. So it can become toxic if it's not well thought through. Yeah. So that's sort of more progress. But to answer the original question, if you're wanting to raise money in the early days, I would say just really try and get the business to a point where you've got something that's working, that people believe in, that you have happy customers. If you have referenceable, happy, raving customers, that's a good start. Understand the market size, and then don't overcomplicate things. Maybe put it into a 10-page deck, investment deck, explaining the problem, the solution, the unfair advantage, and what your next big act is. And the interview we talked about before with Keith Krach, that's K-R-A-C-H. There's two on Unfiltered, but the first one we did, sitting in his house in San Francisco, he talks about this and how to raise money. And he said an investment deck only really needs those slides. I think it was the problem, the solution, how big is the market? What's your next big act? And why can no one beat you, essentially? Right. So you can keep it simple.
Because people write endless proposals. I'm a big believer in the 10-second pitch. I nearly always sold my TV show with the 10-second version of what it was, not the endless pages. Absolutely. So DWC runs a business startup and development course called Co-Starters. What advice would you give someone looking at starting a new business?
Yeah, I would say it's easy to say do it, but I would say if you have a passion for it and you want to start a business, first of all, realize that it is going to be hard. Running a business is not easy. You're going to have sleepless nights. There's going to be plenty of ups and downs. So you have to work out whether you want that stress in your life, because some days I even wonder if I even want it. I mean, there's a ton of stress that comes with it, or pressure, depending on how you process it. That is sometimes good and sometimes drives you, and other days drives you crazy. So you have to work that out. But then what I'd say is find a problem. Probably the best formula for starting a business I've learned from my interviews is find a problem in a specific market that people have, and then fix that problem. So what I mean by that is maybe you can literally start this by looking at industry. So look at, like, let's name five or six industries right now. Real estate industry, you could say lawyers, accountants, you could say tourism, and you could say food and beverage, for example. Okay, you've got some industries to look at. What ones are you passionate about? Maybe I'm really passionate about the real estate industry. Okay, go and talk to 50 real estate agents. You'll be able to find their contact details online, reach out to them and just ask them basically, what are the biggest problems? What are the biggest pain points that you have day to day in your job that doesn't allow you to be as successful as you would like? And have those conversations, go out for drinks, coffee, talk to the real estate agents, research the industry online. And you'll probably pretty quickly find something quite specific that people have a problem for in that industry. And then you can build a solution. And then you can go back to those real estate agents and say, look, this is what you told me. If I were to build this, would this be the kind of thing you would use? And if they say yes, then I'm always a big proponent of trying to sell it before you actually build it, because that takes out a lot of the risk. And I know that sounds scary and easier said than done, and it is, but we did that with Unfiltered, and I certainly don't think we were solving a massive, painful problem. And we still managed to sell a lot of what we did before we built it. So I think back to when we first launched our V1 version of the product, we literally had about 10 interviews on the website. They were all New Zealand focused. They were Diane Foreman. I think I had one with Julie. I had Eric Watson. I had Rob Fife, like 10 interviews. And I literally went to TV. I think we sold subscriptions to TVNZ, Bell Gully, Russell McVeigh, I think Coca-Cola Amatil, and PwC and Spark, I believe, prior to launch. There are some of them. I think we had 12 customers pre-launch. And these are like some of the top companies in the country buying subscriptions to a platform that doesn't yet exist with 12 interviews filmed by an 18-year-old. Like it wasn't revolutionary. So I think if you can identify a really painful problem that people have, build a solution, then you can sell it in advance. But make it industry-specific. That's the most important thing here, because if it's a technology company, there's so many great examples. Amazon did not start being the everything store for everyone doing everything in the world. They started as an online bookstore. Tesla's original target market was green conscious celebrities. That's literally who they targeted. Pushpay, which is a $1 billion New Zealand success story technology company, tried to start by disrupting all payments. Basically failed, ran out of money. The Hewlett family came and invested, I think, $2 million when they were literally, the story's well told, going to go out of business the next week. And at that point, they started focusing, I believe it was right then, they started focusing on the market of faith and churches and facilitating donations in the faith sector in the US specifically. So not even market specific in terms of the product, in terms of the actual geographic market as well. And now there are $1.2 billion company or whatever it is, probably higher now.
Easy to donate.
Exactly. Simply based off that one market. Whereas disrupting payments, you could become Stripe, whatever. But look at Stripe. I don't know what their market cap is, but it's probably, you know, I think 20, 30 billion or whatever. Pushpay is a $1 billion company just targeting churches. So yeah, find that specific market.
If you followed what your model was for a startup, you would have gone and asked churches, what's their biggest problem? And they would have said getting their donations in regularly, whether or not I turn up, like the Catholic Church, you turn up, put your money in the plate. You know, yeah. Like getting Pushpay enabled them to get a continuous flow of cash without people necessarily having to be there. So, yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many industries.
Solve the problem.
Telcos, wine, the wine industry, you could talk to vineyards, you could talk to auto companies, like literally there's hundreds of them. Prisons is a great one. I thought about prisons recently because I went and spoke at the women's prison and I thought, shit, there must be so much stuff that could be done in here to make prisons better around the world. Yeah. And the next thing I'd say though, that's really important as well is, I think the single biggest misconception with business around the world that we constantly hear, and I believe this might not be shared by everyone, but I think 99%, I would say, or 95% of successful entrepreneurs I've met would agree with this, which is the idea is not important. I mean, it is important, but it's not the main thing. We could sit here now and come up with...
I can hear what you're going to say.
great business ideas, and we really could. And then we could give them all to Elon Musk. And if he had the time to do each one individually, he's probably going to build a $1 billion company out of all 10 of them. Whereas, you know, it literally comes down to execution and access to capital, size of market is another really important factor. Size of market, access to capital, and the team are really the three main factors. Team being execution, size of market being how big can it actually become. And thirdly, team, size of market, and access to capital. Because if you're building a tech platform like Pushpay, you're just not going to do it unless you can raise $20, $30, $40 million.
The idea is certainly 5% and the execution is the 95%. Anyone can have a good idea. It's how you execute it. Yeah,
exactly. Very much. Yeah. If anyone needs good ideas, they can send either of us an email. I'm sure we can name 10 payments.
Yeah. Is there a business or an inspirational book you think every business person should read? Is there something you've read that you think everyone should read, or a magazine you should subscribe to?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for me, as I mentioned, losing my virginity sort of had the biggest impact. But for now...
Richard Branson biography.
Yeah, but there's a lot. I mean, I think sales is the most underrated thing about being an entrepreneur, and like actually being able to sell is really important. And I am not the best. I'm still learning it myself. But there's a great book called The Ultimate Sales Machine by a guy called Chet Holmes, who sadly passed away a few years ago. That was a phenomenal book I read as a kid on sales. I'd highly recommend it. Now, what I tend to read is more biographical stuff. I mean, I've got my two books here. I might want to make a cut just for 1 second while I grab them. So the two books I've got on the go, I'll just start fresh.
Let's see.
So the two books I've got on the go right now is Oprah Winfrey, What I Know for Sure.
I've got that here too. I've got that on my bookshelf too.
Yeah, it's a great book. Just basically about things Oprah's learned, what she knows for sure. I love that. And I'm reading a JFK biography, which is really phenomenal as well. So I try and sort of learn about historically relevant people and the lessons we can learn from them. And for me, I think as well, it's important not just to read nonfiction. Like, I try and balance it out with fiction and nonfiction, because you can become a bit of a robot if you're just reading business books all day. Yes. And you become pretty boring at parties when people ask you what you want to talk about, and all you know is like what businesses are working and what I think
I read Jim Collins' Good to Great, and I didn't get any further than that really, but it's pretty much a Bible for business, Good to Great. So
yes, that by the way, that's the book we hear the most in our interviews from the 500 odd interviews we've done. The most successful entrepreneurs, like, in terms of the number of them who have said that book, would be more than any other book in the world.
That's Jim Collins, Good to Great. Yeah. A recent DWC survey on the impact of COVID-19 showed close to 60% of coast businesses expect their revenues to be down at least 25% over the next few months. How are you feeling? Are you seeing any signs of great ideas to try and get us past the effects of COVID?
I mean, it's really hard. And I mean, I certainly don't. I mean, like any businesses, we're all suffering, right? Like, people are simply buying less. So it's really hard when you're out trying to sell products and services to people and everyone's being more careful about the money they spend. And who knows how long that this is all going to continue for. So what I would say is, and I'm sure people are hearing this a lot, but focus on reinvention if you can. Like, if you're in most industries are changing really fast. And use this time to focus on developing your business and doing the things that you've never had the time to do. It's like, if you're the builder, you never have the time to work on your own house. You know, if you're the entrepreneur, you often never have the time to work on your business because you're always working in your business. So this is a phenomenal time to actually focus on your strategy and what does the next, not 6 months look like, but what does the next, you know, 10 years look like? So I would say try and really focus on blue sky sort of horizon stuff. In terms of the immediate struggle we're all going through, I mean, I think firstly, remember that everyone is going through it. So it's nice to know that, it's not nice to know that other people are struggling, but it's, you can have conversations with a lot of other local business people who are going through very similar things. And I'm sure you can share advice locally around that. You know, tactical things, of course, I don't want to tell people how to suck eggs, but obviously just like reducing burn rate is a really important thing in these times. Cut out anything that's not essential. You know, try and keep costs low as possible, while I think looking after your people, because I think a lot of businesses are making quite short-term decisions around their people. And it's easy for me to say when I've only got 4 or 5 full-time people right now, because we were in the process of consciously scaling back New Zealand to rescale up in LA. So we were in a really, I guess, nice time when this occurred comparatively. But I look at certain companies that are jettisoning, you know, thousands of people and then rehiring almost immediately. I was watching CNBC a couple of days ago, and I can't even remember what Denny's, I think it was just hiring 10,000 new people. And I'm like, well, you only got rid of 10,000 people a few months back. Like, and I get that businesses have to make tough decisions, but at the same time, it's quite short-sighted just to get rid of everyone only to then rehire, because what does it tell people about how you're going to look after your people in a moment of hardship? So I get having to make tough decisions to keep a business alive, don't get me wrong, but I would say if you can be a bit more generous and look after people that have been good to you, then that's a good thing to do as well. I think,
I guess we both understand the tough West Coaster mentality, but I wanted to ask you here about people looking after themselves, about your own mental health, you know, the sort of pressure, especially as a founder or the person paying the wages, the personal pressure you can come under can be enormous. You know, you feel like you're carrying your staff around on your shoulders. It can be really tough, and even tougher in times like this.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I'm certainly not immune to that. I mean, it's, you know, and I think the ways to deal with that is you have to work out where you, when you're at your best and where you're at your best, and then do as many things as possible to basically be at your best. So, you know, that should be everything from physical location to health and fitness, to what you're eating, to hydration, to the people you're spending time around with, to the types of exercise you're doing. Work all of those things out. What makes you the happiest? And then it's your responsibility to maximize those things. And hopefully you can stay at your best more often and stay level-headed. You know, I think in these times it's, the other thing is try not to be too hard on yourself, because everybody is going through a lot and we're all going to have various vices, whether that's, you know, too much wine or maybe some medication that we don't necessarily need to be taking for the rest of our life, but is helping right now, doctor prescribed, obviously, whatever it may be, then don't be too hard on yourself. Realize that we are living in one of the craziest times we're ever going to live in for our entire lives, period. And if for the next 2 or 3 months you're having an extra glass of wine at night to go to bed, then don't be too hard on yourself about that, is what I'm saying.
Well, what do you think the biggest challenge facing the West Coast is at the moment?
I would say, at the moment specifically, definitely, obviously, COVID, like, you know, in terms of the current times, just that there's so many businesses down there based off tourism, based off the huge numbers of tourists that typically come into New Zealand and enjoy what is one of the truly most beautiful parts of the world. To not have that inflow of people is incredibly hard. Like, I think back to my parents' skydiving company, and if they own that now, I mean, we would have been either out of business or certainly selling a lot of the planes and the parachutes and stuff, because that just wouldn't have worked. So I don't even begin to imagine what a lot of folks down there are going through. I mean, it must be really hard, like it is in a lot of parts of the world. So I would say, what is the biggest challenge at a macro level normalizing COVID? I would say it's probably just, it's always going to be hard in a small, relatively isolated part of the country to achieve scale with a lot of businesses, because there's just not a huge amount of people there. And that's why I said at the start, you have to work out what's important to you, because if you want to build something that's highly scalable and you want to make many millions of dollars and, you know, export a service and a product around the world, yeah, it's possible with technology and so on to potentially do that from the coast, but it'd be so much harder to do so, because you're limiting yourself to so many different things by simply being that isolated. It's a lifestyle choice that a lot of people have made. So I think it's only going to become easier with technology, but then the downside of that is that it cuts out a lot of businesses. Like, and this has just been going on for years and years and years. And I think back to when I was a kid and my Uncle Sean had the CD shop in Greymouth. I'm sure you remember, it's called Centrepoint Records, I believe. That was my uncle's shop for years. And now I look back and I'm like, CDs, what are they? I mean, I remember going in there all the time and getting CDs, and it wasn't technology that cut my uncle out. What cut my uncle out was the warehouse. And then now the warehouse is getting cut out, because no one's buying stuff from the warehouse, because you buy it from Amazon, right? And you don't need to go and buy a CD from the warehouse, because you buy it from iTunes. So technology is consistently changing, and it cuts out a lot of businesses. And that's why I say, in this time, focus on reinvention, because if you think you're immune to the next great technology threat, you're probably not. Yeah. And we're certainly not, and we're a tech company. So I'm always trying to think, who's going to disrupt us, and what can we do to hopefully stay ahead of that? Yeah.
When will we likely see you home?
Hopefully this Christmas. So the plan is to come down to the coast, and I'm really looking forward to that. So we'll be going to Lake Canary, and I think this year my plan is to do, I always say a week and it always ends up being shorter and shorter each year. So maybe 3 days at Canary this year, then go down to Fox Glacier. I usually go to Motueka and do some skydiving in Abel Tasman. And then I'd love to go and do sort of a week in Totranui. That's where I used to camp as kids, in the Abel Tasman National Park. So looking forward to getting back there as well.
Yeah, fabulous. Forever a coaster. Jake, thank you very much for your time.